Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
I feel like I get just a little bit smarter every time I have a leading academic thinker on the podcast, and today I'm expecting to get a lot smarter. My guest for this episode is Dr. Stephen Cohen of Columbia University, a true pioneer in the field of environmental science. He holds multiple positions at Columbia, including director of the research program on sustainability policy for the university's Earth Institute, where he formerly acted as executive director. He once served on the EPA's National Advisory Council, and he's also written multiple books, including Environmentally Sustainable Growth, A Pragmatic Approach. Dr. Cohen, it is so great to have you with us here on Path to Zero during Climate Week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of stuff to talk about, but let's start right by talking about the Columbia Climate School. We're so, you know, proud of the people we've interviewed and see the work coming from there. And then, more importantly, I think, the Columbia's Earth Institute. What goes on there?
Well, in the late 90s, we had a fellow named Mike Crow, who is the president of Arizona State, and he was the vice provost back then. He brought together faculty from engineering and policy, law, sciences. The idea would be, how are we going to solve the world's environmental problems? And you need a lot of different kinds of people to do that. And so the Earth Institute was created to bring those scholars together in a problem-solving exercise. And it started in the late 90s, and it was built on the foundation of something called the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, which is over 300 environmental scientists. We have a campus for them about 20 miles north of the city, and some of the greatest climate scientists in the world have worked on that campus, and that's what we built the Earth Institute on. And then the Earth Institute is essentially the foundation for Columbia's new climate school.
Wow. You know, I see that multidisciplinary approach more and more, but I mean, really only two or three schools come to mind that are adopting it today, right? I mean, it's and the degree comes from the other schools, correct?
Right. In the case of the Earth Institute, we didn't give degrees. The degrees were in School of International Public Affairs, the School of Professional Studies, the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, Columbia College. We put degrees there. But with the new climate school, they are actually they've started to give their own degrees. But we have partner programs. I run two of those, and then there are programs within the school. It's not clear how this is going to evolve, because in the Earth Institute, our goal was to place environmental studies in all the other schools, and it's happened now. You go to Columbia's architecture school, all they talk about is green buildings. And so you go to the engineering school, there's a whole group that's focused on solar energy and water and all of the different elements of environmental sustainability. So I think we're going to have a little bit of both at Columbia.
I love that the second item in your list is water. As an aside, we never talk enough about water conservation or conservation in general, but we digress. We'll come back to that, because you've written a great book, Environmentally Sustainable Growth, A Pragmatic, and I want to underline pragmatic, A Pragmatic Approach. Talk to us about the book.
Well, what the book is really trying to say is, how did we create these environmental problems? Where did they come from? And then how do we solve them without destroying our economy? I mean,
or maybe can I ask, can we solve them without destroying our economy?
Absolutely. We've actually demonstrated we know how to do this. So in 1970, when the EPA was started, we had a lot of air and water pollution. Today, the water is cleaner and the air is cleaner than it was in 1970. It's not pristine, but it's a lot cleaner. You go to Los Angeles, in 1970, you couldn't see the mountains from downtown LA. Now you can, because we've gotten rid of smog. How did we do it? We applied technology to the problems that technology created. So the internal combustion engine created the pollution, but then we created catalytic converters on the cars. We put stack scrubbers on the power plants, started to use cleaner fuel. And by the application of technology to these problems, we've been able to address them. And that's what we have to continue to do.
I feel like the people who would argue that point say that these problems are too catastrophic your solutions are too slow. You're just mired in the old way of thinking. How do you respond to that?
Well, the problem is we are on this merry-go-round. We require economic growth for political stability. If we don't have economic growth, people get restive in the developed world. They throw out of power the regime that causes the recession. In the developing world, they might turn to terrorism. Mm-hmm. And so political...
And not terrorism, but we're seeing a bit of that in Europe as we speak, right?
Right.
Certainly Germany made a few decisions. A little bit of, you know, turmoil in the elections. Great Britain, same thing for sure.
Right.
We're seeing that in a living laboratory today.
Yeah, political stability requires a certain amount of economic stability and growth. People have to feel that the future is going to be better than the present. And that requires economic growth. Now, what we've demonstrated, though, is that we can grow and reduce pollution at the same time. We just pay more attention to it, and we have to focus ourselves on that task. It requires rules and some regulation, but it really requires technological innovation more than anything else. And we've demonstrated we can do it.
Any easy steps that jump out at you for pragmatic solutions?
Well, I think the thing that we're seeing happen, two things are happening very quickly. First, the electric vehicle is taking off in ways that people didn't fully expect. Part of it is the electric vehicles are better made and simpler to run and cheaper to run than...
Fun to drive.
And the car makers are really getting into some sort of innovative design features, and so people like them. That's part of the idea. You let the market help solve some of these problems, but you have to put the market in a position to do that. So, I mean, the way I sometimes put it, Henry Ford might have invented the Model T, but he didn't build any roads. He needed infrastructure for that to happen. We need charging stations. We need renewable energy to be the main source of energy, and we need electric vehicles. So that's one part. The second part is the innovations we're seeing in solar energy and particularly battery technology. And we're seeing this happen really, really fast. And so I think we're going to see more and more use of renewable energy, more and more use of batteries. Just as people are disconnecting from cable TV and have even disconnected from the internet to use the wireless, you're going to see more and more households going to their own form of energy because it'll save them money.
Mm-hmm. So you think a lot of people won't rely on the grid in the future the way we rely on a centralized network of power?
We're going to still have the centralized network because it'll be places like hospitals and universities and factories that need more power than they can generate on their own site. But then there'll be lots of households that can generate their own energy. I mean, the biggest single adopter of new solar power in America right now is Walmart. And they're doing it because they have a lot of the flat roofs.
Right.
And they use a lot of energy in their stores. And they're doing it in part for climate reasons, but mainly for cost reasons.
Right. Yeah, rooftop solar makes a ton of sense if you have a 5-acre flat roof, right?
And it's getting, and the solar arrays are going to keep getting cheaper. The same way, when I was in graduate school, I used a computer the size of my living room, and it had less computing power than my iPhone. Well, eventually, computers got much smaller, and you can carry them in your pocket. So we're seeing some of the same thing happening with solar arrays and with batteries, and I think that is a technological innovation that's going to be transformative.
You've written, how many books have you written total?
I don't know, maybe a dozen.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I want to talk about a second book for sure, The Sustainable City. Interestingly, something that I worked on early on in my career and didn't think about it again until now, this part. And here at Climate Week this week, we've talked about walkable cities, heat domes. We've talked about the problems that climate change really seems to exacerbate in urban areas as opposed to rural areas. But in your book, The Sustainable City, you talked about the transitioning to a green economy really depends on cities being able to participate, for lack of a better word, right? Talk to us about what you meant with that.
Why
is it so important for the city to participate?
Well, for two reasons. One is you want to concentrate population as opposed to spread out throughout rural areas. You want to be able to preserve the biodiversity of the surrounding countryside. And if everybody is moving out into exurban and rural areas, then you won't have that anymore. So that's one problem. But the other is the economy of scale of having people living closer together. You can make more efficient energy systems, water system, waste systems. I mean, one of the things that I see coming is a different kind of recycling. I mean, the kind of recycling we have now where people try to separate stuff at home and then it gets picked up separately has proven to not work very well.
Right.
So what we're going to do is eventually is the garbage will go in a single stream, and then we're going to use artificial intelligence and robotics to mine the garbage for the resources, whether it's food, which can then be turned into fertilizer, whether it's going after the metals and the different chemicals that we want to take and reuse. Right now, a lot of our raw materials come out of the crust of the planet. Eventually, there are so many minerals in use that instead of dumping them into landfills, we're going to mine the waste stream and probably even the landfills for those same resources, because with robotics and artificial intelligence, it becomes possible to do this in a fairly cost-effective way. But it's best to do it when there's a lot of garbage, like in a city like New York.
So it's a fascinating logic and one I kind of support. And by the way, you know, there are a lot of benefits to cities, right, that aren't afforded to those who live in the country. Is it possible then that our energy delivery system might even be to a degree two-tier? We have a different system in the urban areas. And then, for example, propane, which is really quite well thought of as a fuel of the country, would continue to be in those lower density, population density areas.
We're going to have a lot of different technologies. I mean, I have a friend who has a house up in the country, and he has a geothermal system. And so there are many different technologies that can be used to deliver energy. But what cities provide also is the ability to create public spaces so that people don't just rely on their own private spaces. For example, I live across the street from a park. I live in an apartment building. So if I want to go outside, I have to leave my property to go to the park. If I had a private home, I would go in the backyard. The collective use of that public space means that we use less of it. Also, my ceiling is the floor of my neighbor. And so when I heat my apartment, or I'm heating the floor of the apartment above me. You know, Paul Simon said, one man's ceiling is another man's floor. And so that means that the energy use in apartment buildings per capita is much less expensive. And if you have less private space, but nicer and grander and more accessible public spaces, then you can have more people using less space. So the average home in the suburbs may be 3,000-4,000 square feet. A big apartment in New York City is 1,500 square feet.
Right.
And so the use of space for people, the accessibility of restaurants and entertainment and the arts by walking to them, those are all things that you can do in cities that are harder to do in rural areas. Although, one of the things we're seeing in many rural areas is the revival of small towns. And so people can drive from their country homes to those small towns, but also people now are living in those towns. And that kind of thing is starting to happen as well.
Big debate. As we think about rural versus urban, big debate about the energy systems, the true infrastructure that we need to support, kind of where I think the current logic is, wind and solar to a degree, that's generally foisted into the rural areas for the benefit, most would see, of the urban areas. And then, of course, we have that problem of getting wires from A to B. How do you enter that argument?
Well, first, there's this assumption that we're going to have to have big centralized renewable energy facilities, and we're going to need some of those. But the projections of how many we need don't really account for the technological change we're going to see in solar power and in battery technology. So right now, if you wanted to build a solar array on your home and have a good battery system, you need $15,000 for the solar array, and maybe you buy one or two of those $3,000 Tesla batteries. You're talking about a heavy-duty investment. But what if those solar arrays become something that through nanotechnology get much smaller and cheaper, in fact are embedded in your windows, you don't even need to put them on the roof. I could have one in my apartment, and the battery is the size of my laptop instead of the size of my living room wall. Now, all of that is completely imaginable. I told you the story about the computer. Well, that's batteries are getting more efficient and smaller, and solar arrays are getting more efficient. And so imagine 15 years from now, you can get off the grid with a $300 battery and a $300 investment in new windows, and you can use the grid 10% of the time. Right. And so the demand on the grid becomes lower. So this is the thing that we haven't quite figured out yet. How much of the energy will be distributed and how much will be generated centrally?
You know, as a person who works every day in distributed power, it's I love the logic. And I really share that view that technology, which delivered us these problems, can also deliver the solutions.
I don't think we have a lot of choice because, as I said, the political stability of the world depends on us maintaining and, in fact, growing a high-throughput economy. And so the other thing that's happening is the nature of consumption itself is changing. And that's one of the things I point out in the book. What kinds of things people need and what's the resource base of those things? Those things are also changing. And so we're seeing cultural change. When I was growing up, every teenager wanted to have their own car. And they wanted a car not just to get places, but they wanted to show it off to their friends.
Status.
When I was in college in Indiana, there was a place called the Dog and Suds, and everybody used to drive around town and do what they called buzzing the suds, and this was recreation. Well, the average teenager, unless they're in a rural area, really isn't that interested in a car because they don't want to park it, they don't want to maintain it, they don't want to pay for it. And so for them, an Uber or Lyft will get them where they want to go, or, you know, other vehicles or bicycles. And so, I think the nature of consumption is changing and the nature of our economy is changing. In the United States, 80% of our GDP is in the service economy. Now, people are worried we don't make anything in America, and we're going to probably bring some of that manufacturing back. But most of the jobs and most of the economy is in services. And we have invented jobs nobody ever heard of before. At the Earth Institute, we have full-time events managers. 20 years ago, there were no events managers. When we bring new students to Columbia, we have a whole group of people working on their moving in. We close streets. We do all these kinds of things where, again, 20 or 30 years ago, you'd never do those things. So the way economic life is changing is making material consumption still important, but less central than it was 30, 40 years ago.
And in your book, Environmentally Sustainable Growth with a Pragmatic Approach, we don't really have to worry so much about human factors because the shift that you're putting on there is almost consumer-driven rather than, again, government-mandated.
Right. I mean, the government...
So therefore, the human piece of this is much easier to understand.
The government provides incentives. Like I said, Henry Ford built the Model T, but he didn't build the roads. So someone has to build the infrastructure, and we need those things. The other thing that I write about in the book that I think is really important is we have to get past the ideological divides, the young environmentalists shaming people for, having an SUV when, I need that SUV to get my family around town. So, that's important to our way of life. When we passed all the environmental bills in the United States in the 70s, there was an alliance between the Republicans and the Democrats that were totally bipartisan. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act in 1972 was passed over Richard Nixon's veto. the combination of Democrats and Republicans, and support for environmental protection has always been about 70%, never has changed, and continues. And the alliance that created this was between urban environmentalists and hunters and anglers. I mean, the National Wildlife Federation, which is the biggest environmental group in America, is still mainly made up of people that hunt and fish. And so the urban vegan environmentalist has to make common cause with the hunters and the people that fish, because that all of them are in favor of preserving the planet. And so that that political change where they're fighting each other is very destructive.
You've been around a while, you've seen a lot, you know, in this current conversation. What surprises you? Where are we on the right track? Where do you think we need to change the conversation?
Well, what I think is terrific is the degree to which America's corporations are buying into the need to pay attention to environmental issues as they produce. So in about 10 years ago, corporations started to write their annual corporate ESG reports, and about 10% of the top 500 S&P companies did them. Last year it was 92%. We are about to see the Securities and Exchange Commission require publicly traded companies to disclose their carbon footprint and start reporting on their environmental risk. That is a sea change. When we start to talk about environmental protection as part of good management, which I think it is, but corporations are internalizing that. Part of it is they want to save money, part of it is they want to reduce their liability, and part of it is the young people that they want to attract to work for them are insisting on it. And so I think that's probably the most significant change we're seeing here in the United States, and it has nothing to do with ideology, this idea that somehow this is woke capitalism or something like that. This is simply organizations understanding we live on a crowded planet. We want to continue to make money, and to do that, we better pay attention to our environmental footprint.
Mm-hmm. Well said. You know, we have a great tradition on this podcast that we use magic. I want to give you a magic wand. You get to use it one time for one thing in the next year. So 111 that you think would have the most significant impact on climate.
I think the one thing would be to see that technological breakthrough in solar energy, both the receivers of solar power and the storage of solar energy, or of any energy for that matter.
So you skip over nuclear fusion, right over that, you skip over hydrogen, and you go to affordable solar.
Yeah, I mean, I think had nuclear power not been developed the way we developed it, which was to take fission right off the bomb and turn it into a power technology, had we gone, had the patience for fusion, in the long term, I think we are going to see safe development of nuclear energy, but it's not going to come in time for the mm-hmm. climate crisis. But I think that no single technology would have as big an impact. And if you had a transformative technology, I mean, part of how new technologies get adopted is people figure they're better and cheaper, and better means that they work really well and they're easy to use. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with solar power is just the barriers to entry.
Right.
But if it became simpler and cheaper, mm-hmm. People would do it. And we're starting to see that with electric vehicles, because there's companies growing up that will put in your driveway a charging station, and it's getting cheaper. And so those technologies, as they come, are going to transform the way we live, just as the technology that created the motor vehicle transformed the way we live. So here in New York City, in 1906, the biggest environmental problem we had was horse manure. We were knee-deep in it. 10 years later, the internal combustion engine was adopted completely. The cars take over. We have elevated trains, but the horses are gone, and so is the horse manure. So we didn't tax the horse. We just developed a better technology that people wanted to use, and I think that's essentially the answer on environmental sustainability.
Do you think we have the wherewithal, the ability to get something as dramatic a change as that?
Well, think of what we've done just with, say, watching a movie at home. So you used to have to watch Saturday Night at the Movies on TV, and then you had to watch it Saturday night. Then we had video cassettes, then we had DVDs, then now we have streaming video. You know, all of those things happen really quickly, and people didn't even realize they happened. Same thing with the smartphone. I mean, everybody now walks out of the house, they check for their wallet and keys, maybe their wallet, I don't know, but they definitely look to see if they've got their smartphone with them. And so those technologies came about within a generation. And so I think we're going to see the same thing with energy, because energy is more important than watching a movie.
We love to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of the time you spend with us and the expertise you've shared with us. Any particular national forest come to mind?
Well, I was thinking about that, and I have to say that I actually have a local forest I'm more interested in. We have something called Black Rock Forest, which is north of New York City, right by West Point.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually a forest that is used as an ecological station.
Oh, wow.
We have, there's a building, a couple of buildings there where high school kids go up and they spend the night and they hike in the woods, New York City high school kids. And so I don't know if you would change your habit, but something for Black Rock Forest, which is an educational and research facility right by West Point, that would be great.
Sounds lovely, and we will do that. Let's finish on a high note. You've written a wonderful book. It's not a hard read. I encourage people to buy it and read it. What's a really good point that you found as you were researching this book and writing it? What's the hopeful story for us?
The hopeful story is that we have already started this transition to environmental sustainability. Like a lot of these transitions, they take a while. I'll give you an example of one here in New York City. So in 1950, 95% of the clothing worn in America was made right here in New York City. Last year it was about 1%. We lost 500,000 garment workers as that industry left New York City. But what it got replaced by was 150,000 people that design and market clothing. So, and still make samples of clothing. So New York City used to be the manufacturing city. We used to make a lot of things in New York. Now we almost went bankrupt. We lost 1 million people. But then in the 90s and after that, it all came back into a service economy. We have 66 million tourists coming here every year. We have the United Nations, which is down the street right now. And so my optimism is that, in fact, human ingenuity solves lots of problems, and human energy solves problems. And so in New York City, you know, the city was in big trouble in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, people say now we have, in the post-COVID era, what's going to happen to downtowns? Something will happen. So all those garment factories became artist studios in Soho, which eventually became sold to stores and rich people for their homes. Tribeca is filled with art galleries and restaurants and, again, high-end apartments. We have the High Line. In other words, New York City reinvented itself. We had a transition from being a manufacturing city to being the city it is today. We're at the beginning of the transition to being a sustainable city. So our use of renewable energy, mass transit, bicycle transportation, all sorts of things are changing right in front of us. And these transitions are not obvious to everybody. It takes a while before the momentum picks up and you really see it. And I think we're at that point in this transition. The point I'm always telling my students is look to see how many electric vehicles you see on the road, because in 10 years, it won't be an unusual sight anymore.
Yeah, well said. Love that optimism. Love the book. Dr. Stephen Cohen, Columbia Climate School, another one of our great guests from the Columbia School. Thank you so much for being with us on Path to Zero.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.